Some recent events caught our eye. The attempted attack on the American embassy in Iraq. And the reporting last week that not only did President Trump's personal lawyer Rudy Giuliani interfere in policy in Ukraine, he was part of a move to intercede in Venezuela. Well, both reminded us of the late 1970s, when David Rockefeller, heir to the Standard Oil fortune and head of Chase Bank, also conducted shadow diplomacy to convince a reluctant President Jimmy Carter to bring the Shah of Iran, deposed in the 1979 revolution, to the U.S. Now, Carter's decision would prompt angry Iranians who wanted the Shah tried for corruption to attack the U.S. embassy in Tehran and take 52 hostages for 444 days through the next American election, which Carter lost to Ronald Reagan. Carter perhaps oblivious as to who was pulling the strings behind the scenes. Terrence Smith, then a rising star at the New York Times, wrote about those puppet masters in a 1981 piece. And now, nearly 40 years later, the Times' David Kirkpatrick uses Rockefeller's private minutes to corroborate much of what Smith wrote, that an old boys' club was running the show. Terrence Smith, now retired from the New York Times, joins us from Annapolis. Terry, welcome.
Thank you.
What did you think when you saw this deeper reporting on something that you had this by the tail back in 81? Joe Reed, the chief of staff to then Chase Bank chair David Rockefeller, saying things like the eagle has landed when they successfully brought the Shah into the United States.
Well, it was absolutely haunting to read it because here were the notes, the actual documents, the notes that they took during a real campaign to persuade President Carter to admit the Shah to the United States, a decision he had resisted and did not want to do, he out of both concern for the diplomats in the U.S. Embassy in Tehran and for broader reasons. But David Rockefeller was a great friend and supporter of the Shah of Iran, along with Henry Kissinger and John J. McCloy. And so they had their own agenda, as you say, their own foreign policy, if you like, which was to persuade President Carter to admit the Shah. And so they mounted quite a campaign to do it.
Well, he had an affection for the Shah. And by the way, David Rockefeller says that's all this was. There were many on the conservative side who felt the U.S. shouldn't abandon an ally. When you said Carter had other considerations, one of them was to try to forge some kind of relationship with the new government in Iran for the benefit of the country, knowing that if the Shah came to the United States, that would not happen. That was a big concern. David Rockefeller would deny this, but there are some who suspected it was because Chase Bank stood to benefit. The Shah had a lot of money. Chase wanted him and his money safe in the U.S.
Well, it was a fact that the Chase Manhattan Bank, David Rockefeller's bank, had very close and very profitable relations with Iran when the Shah was on the throne. In fact, by 1979, the bank had syndicated more than $1.7 billion in loans for Iranian public projects. And that's the equivalent of maybe $5.8 to $6 billion today. So as they say in Washington, there was real money involved.
Yeah. And the Shah had been put into position by U.S. and other interests. And then you have in 1978 this huge uprising against him, millions of Iranians protesting in the streets. They want him gone. Here's an ABC report from December 30th, 1978.
The old chant of death to the Shah was replaced today by a new one, death to Carter. There is still a strong sentiment against American interests in Iran and the widespread belief that the United States has taken the profits from Iranian oil.
And this is, of course, what Jimmy Carter felt he had to overcome.
Exactly right. And you're right, Robin, that President Carter did want to try to establish relations and a relationship with the new leaders in Iran in order to sustain that alliance, which had been so important in the region for so long. Mm-hmm. So he had reasons not to let the Shah in to the United States. And the Shah, remember, had gone on this odyssey. Henry Kissinger at the time called him the Flying Dutchman, mm-hmm. traveling to Egypt and the Bahamas and Mexico, trying to find, in effect, a place to land with his family and a small coterie of supporters. And yet here were David Rockefeller, Henry Kissinger, John J. McCloy, who'd been an attorney for the Shah, all pressuring President Carter through indirect means to do what he didn't want to do, which was admit the Shah to the United States. And that's why the outbreak and violence in the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad in the last couple of days is so haunting, because it's almost a carbon copy of what happened in Tehran, actually 9 months before the hostages were taken, and then again when the hostages were taken.
Because there had been an attack on the U.S. embassy 9 months before, and hostages were taken, but a negotiation occurred. They were released. And then this far more meaningful hostage taking took place just after the Shah came into the United States.
Exactly right. 2 weeks later, this is the way the Iranians responded.
So the way that the Shah gets into the United States, the way you painted in your 1981 article, is that this coterie of people backing the Shah, including the Rockefellers at Chase Bank, relayed a message to Jimmy Carter that the Shah is much sicker than he really is. He is sick, and that a U.S. hospital would be the only place to treat him. It sounds like they lied to Carter.
Well, Carter was certainly misinformed. There's no question about that. In January of 1981, when he was no longer president, I went down and interviewed him on this very question. Sitting in his living room in Plains, I asked him why he had admitted the Shah, a decision that ultimately cost him the presidency. And he said, well, I was told that he was close to death and that the Shah needed to come to New York for medical treatment, and that New York was the only place where he could get this. I had interviewed Dr. Benjamin Keene, who had examined the Shah and knew firsthand that that was not true. So I said to the president, you know that's not correct, that he was not at the point of death, and New York was not the only facility that could save him. In fact, the work that needed to be done could have been done anywhere, including in Mexico, where he was. Well, the president got very agitated at that point and insisted vehemently to me that that's what he had been told. And I don't doubt him for a minute.
Well, and the result was the hostage taking saw the rise of Ronald Reagan. In fact, Jimmy Carter worked every single second right up till the moment, I think, that Ronald Reagan was standing on the inaugural platform to get the hostages released. Carter did get them released. Reagan took credit. Have I got that right?
That is correct. That happened on the day that Ronald Reagan was inaugurated president.
Yeah.
And what these latest papers show you from Joseph Reed, they show you that Rockefeller and his people were working very closely with the Reagan administration. He was, after all, a Republican. And they were working very closely with the Reagan campaign to avoid what they called an October surprise. In other words, the release of the hostages immediately before the election, which probably would have put Carter over the top.
Right. Instead, they held off on that. The new documents reveal the Chase team helped the Reagan campaign spread rumors about Carter paying Iranians for the hostages, which outraged Americans, and Carter's people said delayed talks on the release. And it's not just that, Terry. We're reminded that it's been the fraught relations since, I mean, that bring us right to this week's attacks by Iranian-backed militia members and protesters on the U.S. embassy in Baghdad. I mean, it's really a stunning through line. But as you watch reports of this shadow foreign diplomacy being run today, you know, there are supporters of President Trump who are saying, look, it's no big deal. It's happened forever. The difference is that President Trump doesn't hide it, sends his personal lawyer around the world to try to gin up investigations. Your thoughts on that?
Right. I would argue this is much more direct. This is the president's personal lawyer, as you said, Rudy Giuliani, taking an active role to try to bring about events that would, he hoped, help President Trump in his reelection and damage his presumed opponent, Joe Biden. So this is much more direct.
President Carter resisted and didn't know how much he was being misled.
Absolutely did not know it. Insisted that he was told what he was told And that's why he did what he did. So this, I would argue, today is a much more blatant and out front, obvious manipulation by, in this case, the president's personal lawyer, than what you had before was positively subtle and gentlemanly by comparison.
But I guess overall, it just seems to be a reminder of why shadow diplomacy may not, you know, shadow citizen diplomacy just may not be a good idea.
Not at all. And as you say, it's not new.
Yeah. Terrence Smith, a New York Times legend who wrote the story, Why Carter Admitted the Shah, more than 40 years ago. We're revisiting it thanks to some new documents and new reporting. We'll link you to all of it at herenow.org. Terry, thanks so much.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.